People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Dr. Shannon Charlebois is fed up with gambling ads during sports. She says she thinks a number of Canadians must feel the same way, based on the response to an editorial she co-authored in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, called Protecting Canada's Youth from the Risks of Exposure to Gambling Advertising. The article generated widespread media attention. Charlebois says co-author Dr. Sean Kelly has since been invited to speak to issues of gambling advertising and youth before the Canadian Senate. I spoke with Dr. Shannon Charlebois.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Shannon Charlebois. I'm the medical editor at the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and I'm also a family doctor.
And can you tell me what prompted you to come out with this editorial speaking to the issue of gambling, sports gambling, advertising, and youth?
Sure. I wrote this editorial because the whole thing was just ticking me off. The situation is ticking me off. It's ticking off lots of Canadians. The editorial discusses how pervasive gambling and sports betting ads have become on any kind of sport watched in Canada. Particularly our national sports of hockey, but also other huge sports like soccer, and anything you can think of is there. I was speaking with my pediatrician, Dr. Sean Kelly, who turned out to be my co-author, and the anger, the raw anger he feels about this, because he sees the harms, as do I, in our patients and out in the community.
Could you outline maybe what you feel the extent of the problem is?
Sure. So the University of Bristol in the UK did a study on the NHL final game this year, the Oilers versus the Panthers. And in the broadcast they watched, they found that there was a gambling ad every 13 seconds, whether it was a logo, a sponsored segment, or an advertisement. So I'm watching that game with my kids, and every 13 seconds on average, they're seeing some promotion of gambling. I've got my 8-year-old who wants me to place bets for him. And these ads really are genius. They just go in, and the industry is preparing its next generation of customers and current customers too. Because the rebuttal that, oh, well, kids can't gamble because they're not 19, is just wrong, and the gambling companies know this.
Could you tell me more about that idea of, well, theoretically, youth aren't allowed to use some of these platforms or they can't gamble? Where does that break down, you feel?
Well, there's a lot of things that youth can't do, they do anyways, and there's a lot of things that adults can't legally do, and they do anyways. So even before single-game sports betting was legalized in Canada in 2021, back in 2019, we knew kids were gambling. They're doing this in a bunch of different ways. There's the traditional methods, but there's also the more subtle methods of gambling, even among their peers. Their parents are involved in this sometimes, and a bit complicit, to be honest. But there's in video games, you can buy loot boxes. You are gambling. You're spending real money to get some unknown potential benefit. So in 2019, we knew that 4% of Canadian teenagers were experiencing some harms from gambling. And I don't mean just they lost a bet. And we knew that 2% met criteria for gambling addiction. That was 2019. I don't have numbers updated, but now that we're inundating them with sports betting ads, and they can get around those age restrictions. Some of the apps, you just need to say you're 19. Others will play using a parent's name with a parent's credit card to the tune of thousands of dollars. I know one 17-year-old who gambled away his college fund because he was worried it wasn't high enough. Kids don't have the executive decision-making skills, play the tape forward type brains that they do once they have fully formed neurological measures when they're 25 or around there. This just plays right into what appeals to a teenager, because they're evolutionarily, biologically geared to take risks. They're geared to value peer influence. And when they see these ads that have cars and parties and members of whatever sex they're attracted to and tigers, I mean, these are all things a teenager looks at and thinks, well, that looks great. It's integrated now into the game broadcasts themselves, where you have sponsored segments, you have logos everywhere. You even in some cases have logos broadcast onto the playing field or surface or whatever it is. And teenagers and especially and children, my children now are growing up in a world where they can't separate that gambling is a fun way to augment being a spectator and the sport itself. And these things are very different. People will say to me, oh, but gambling is a form of entertainment. Most people have no problems. But the truth is, it's an addiction, and it's addiction that kills. Studies have been done in comparator countries like the UK, where the risk of suicide increases in those aged 16 to 24 by 9 times for males, 9 times the risk of suicidality. A study in Norway found that among gambling addicts, suicide was the leading cause of death when they followed people over a 13-year period. That's pretty bad. Canadians are dying. We know that. From suicide linked to gambling addiction, but more Canadians, many more, are just being destroyed by gambling addictions of all ages. And if we talk about the social determinants of health, the people that are most affected, what the studies show, are those of lower socioeconomic status, males, and people who live in rural and remote areas. That is what the evidence has shown for the last 50 years among gambling studies in Canada. And that tracks with what the global literature shows.
There are a number of layers to this. So there's the fact that single game sports gambling is legal. There's the fact that you can do it online from a smartphone. There's the advertising element to it. There's the frequency of the advertising element to it. How would you begin to break down all of these layers to say these are the specific areas where you feel a change is called for?
If you want to ask me what I want to see, and this is not the ideal, which would be no sports betting ads altogether, because I've seen this destroy adult lives. But if you, I would take a draw on no sports betting ads before 9 p.m. No sports betting ads, i.e., where minors are likely to see them, because really, if they're playing these ads in things like hockey games and soccer games, they're directly marketing to youth, and that's against national advertising standards. But these companies are not dumb. They're creating their next generation of customers. And we're allowing that. And why do we allow it? Well, because it generates tax revenues. These gambling corporations end up paying a lot of money to the jurisdiction or province where they are operating. The first few years of following the sports betting legalization, the Ontario government made $1.4 billion in tax revenues. And so what I would like is whistle to whistle on any sports broadcast, no betting ads, just in general, but certainly no betting ads until 9 p.m. and for the 5 minutes after a game ends. That is what is being moved into the British system slowly. And I think that's the bare minimum we can do for our kids. This is no different than eliminating ads for other harmful things like cigarettes, or sugary cereals. If we can get rid of Tony the Tiger, we can get rid of these sports betting.
We have seen an evolution with the advertising where, when this first came into play, you could see celebrities just straight up advertising some of these betting platforms. And then there was a shift such that now they can only be in the ads if they are in some way promoting measures like guardrails or responsible gambling measures. You wrote in your editorial that warnings to game responsibly have, however, been shown in a systematic review of 166 studies to be ineffective. I'm wondering if you could tell me more about that idea.
Sure. So it's not just that these strategies don't work. What they're actually doing is achieving the opposite of what they are on surface. They're promoting, and they use that word, promoting safe gambling, which is the same as promoting gambling. It's sneaky. In Ontario, they had ads of celebrities, Connor McDavid, showing how glamorous gaming is. And that, again, for younger people who are more influenced by celebrity, that is huge. That is hugely effective. And so Ontario passed a weak law saying, oh, no more celebrities promoting gambling, which was, you know, very nice of them, except that within days they allowed ads of Connor McDavid back again promoting responsible gaming. This is just another way of advertising. It circumvents the law. They allowed it immediately. It was absolutely ludicrous. So yes, responsible gaming. I mean, if you're a cocaine addict, there's no such thing as responsible cocaine use. The same applies to alcoholism. The same applies, you know, to any major addiction. That is true. So the people the gambling companies make their money off of are the heavy users. And for the heavy users, we know that responsible gambling, that putting up, you know, guardrails don't work. The guardrails don't work partially because people can get around them. If even if you manage to block yourself from a website, it's difficult to block yourself for life irrevocably. You can usually get back on within 24 hours. And there's always another platform for you to gamble on. You mentioned smartphones. 24 hours a day, you can be on a smartphone and placing a bet on anything. You can take these, you know, parlay bets. You can bet on what color, I don't know, which jersey the team's wearing, which referees are going to be there, whether or not this person's going to make their free throw. And in fact, we have college athletes and university athletes who are threatened on social media because they didn't make the free throw that, or whatever point it was, that someone had bet on. It's just corrupting sports, and sports are a great thing. You know, my brother was an elite hockey player. I grew up with someone who saw the benefits of teamwork and hard work paying off. That is the opposite of what gambling is. And for these two things to be conflated in my son's mind at 8 years old is pretty disturbing.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Shannon Charlebois, medical editor at the Canadian Medical Association Journal. We're speaking about gambling advertising and youth, which was the subject of a recent editorial co-authored by Charlebois. When it comes to a number of behaviors that, from a public health perspective, are harmful to people, there can be a lot of discourse or questions or back and forth on the idea of if this becomes too hard to do in a kind of accessible, regulated way, then people will just go to the black market. I'm wondering if you were approaching this issue of gambling with a clean slate, how would you try and create a system that tries to thread that needle?
Now, there is a big question. You know, I don't think I've ever considered that before because I personally, you know, to be completely honest, don't understand gambling. Never have. I go to a casino, you know, I'm playing penny slots. My betting max would be $20. I just don't get it. I work hard for my money, always have. I'm not giving it to somebody else, but I get it. This is something people really like. So I don't have a great answer because yes, we do generate tax revenues off things that harm people. You know, alcohol is the same, of course, cigarettes, you know, there are good things and bad things to that because it does make the public complicit, in the problem. You know, we take so much tax revenue off of alcohol sales and yet one of the top causes of emergency visits and illness and early death in Canada is related to alcohol, whether it's traffic accidents or any of the other medical things that can go wrong for people who love to drink. So I don't have a good answer for you because you're kind of asking me an impossible question. How do I take something that for a certain percentage of the population is going to be absolutely ruinous and destructive and make that essentially family friendly? And I just don't know the answer to that. I think we're getting into a complex ethical debate then or exploration, and I just don't know.
There's a bill that's making its way through the Senate right now, and that bill would basically require the relevant minister to develop and implement a strategy on this issue within a specific time frame. Do you see that bill as having a reasonable chance at making its way into law in the near future?
Well, let me tell you, Bill S-211 would allow for a federal jurisdiction, a federal movement which is really what's needed, because piecemeal movements by the province, such as the Connor McDavid's responsible gambling ads, are not going to cut it, because the provinces and territories have a conflict of interest. They're benefiting from sports betting. So what we need is federal legislation. The bill is not itself a piece of federal legislation that will go as far as I want it to, that will make a meaningful, immediate difference. But it sets the stage. It's the start we need. So Bill S-211 is being actually now, since this editorial has come out, discussed before the Senate on October 8th. And the co-author of this editorial will be the co-speaker, has just been invited to speak for the Senate. So this is wonderful news for us. So we're hoping this bill gets through and that some inroads can start to be made.
You wrote in your editorial that allowing glaring and ubiquitous promotion of sports betting is a willful mortgage of Canada's future to the interests of private profit and tax revenue. What do you think happens down the line if this isn't addressed?
Well, problem gambling is going up, and I have the stats to prove that, because the people it's going up in are the 18 to 24 set. The people who can legally gamble, it's the young ones now who are doing it at unprecedented levels. So if that trend continues, and of course it will, when our kids are growing up with associating this with sports, on top of all the different ways to gamble that outside of sports, the normalization of it, the number of people in Canada who are going to be harmed by problem gambling, which is in turn going to have a spill effect on the ones they love, it's going to increase crime. We know gambling in youth and anyone really is associated with an increase. Number of criminal activities, including theft, of course, as they try and fuel their habit or pay off their debts to the black market, which is also a problem. Those two things are intertwined with the legal market. So theft, weapons charges, assault charges. Right now, a significant proportion of Canadian youth who are incarcerated, I think it's around 30% ballpark. I'd have to get the stat for you. Around a third of incarcerated Canadian youth endorse a history of problem gambling. So this goes along with the other reasons that other determinants of what lands people in prison, which tends to be lower income individuals, racialized individuals, people with other psychiatric comorbidities, and people with substance use. And gambling goes right along with most of those things.
You mentioned off the top of our conversation that this was something you wanted to write about because it was really bugging you, and especially when this was maybe a new change and there was this wave of new gambling ads, it seemed like even beyond people who had concerns about this from the public health angle, there were a lot of people expressing views, whether that was on social media, in editorials, in conversations at the pub, that they just found this really, really annoying and didn't like it. And I'm wondering if you feel like that kind of sentiment has a chance to spur some action on this, or whether we're kind of settling into a place of apathy a few years down the line.
Well, I think we are sort of at that benchmark of where most Canadians are annoyed by this, by these ads, even just because they don't want to look at them anymore. But we have hit that sort of critical point of, are we going to put up with it? Or now, after we've seen what's happened over 4 years, are we going to say to our political leaders, okay, let's now do something about this. It's equivalent to any advertising any other harmful substance. It's annoying. It's hurting our youth. It's hurting the entire adult population. And so that's why I wrote the editorial too, because I'm starting to see that complacency where maybe I hear less grumbling about it, or I notice it less myself when I'm watching these ads. And once I started to look into it and look at some of the associated statistics and evidence, I was appalled. And so I wrote the editorial. So I'm really hoping, and we've seen such attention to this one publication from media coast to coast in Canada, that I think we've clearly hit a nerve in the public. And hopefully this helps focus that energy towards advocacy to political leaders to say, okay, we called you on it. Now you got to fix it.
What does this issue look like in other jurisdictions? Is there anywhere we can look to for maybe hope of this, if that's fair to say, reaching a resolution or an improvement?
So There are countries where gambling advertising has been outlawed completely. That would be my ideal, but I don't think that's going to happen. Those countries don't have comparable political systems, economies to Canada. So let's look at Australia and the UK. Australia is having the same problems as us. When I speak to Australian family, they're just as irritated by this, if not more, than I am. The UK is interesting because they've had problems with gambling for a very long time. You know, their single game sports betting goes back two decades. And they do see a huge amount of crime that's attributable directly or indirectly to it. They see high rates of addiction in their youth. And they see really the social fallout. You know, sure, it generates a little tax revenue, but there's real world costs to this. So the UK had tried to push, and this is being implemented to a degree, is my understanding, of a whistle-to-whistle policy, where from the game beginning till 5 minutes after the game ends, there's no sports betting allowed. And they've taken the things off the player jerseys. They've taken out all of the things that annoy me when I'm trying to watch a hockey game. That's up until 9 p.m. And after 9 p.m., it's more of a free-for-all. That's not, from my understanding and my reading, that's not across all sports. So, and people will bet on any outcome, as I think listeners who are acquainted with sort of the harms of gambling know right now. People will go online at 4 a.m. and bet on a ping pong ball tournament. But at least in the UK, we're seeing strides, but we're also seeing where it evolved in order to make those strides possible. And they're having a very difficult time putting through legislation that's all encompassing because the problem is so embedded. I think that's a cautionary tale as well as a place to look for one example. And I think that idea is great. Whistle to whistle, nothing before 9 p.m. Canada can at least do as well as that.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation on this issue today?
Write your local member of parliament and tell them to pass Bill S-211.
Shannon Charlebois, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
My pleasure.
Dr. Shannon Charlebois is a family doctor and is medical editor at the Canadian Medical Association Journal.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A Vancouver Island author is exploring the story of a mother caught in a cycle of intergenerational violence. Most Grievous Fault from Meg Todd tells the story of Crystal and her teenage daughter, Becky. The story deals with difficult subject matter, including abuse, rape, addiction, and poverty. Todd says it was important for her to address the difficult topics in the book head on, but without judgment. I spoke with her about her debut novel.
My name is Meg Todd, and I live in North Saanich. I lived in Vancouver for over 20 years, and before that, the prairies and outside of Calgary. And I teach exercise and have done that for over 40 years. And I write, and I started writing quite late in life. And I'm wanting to talk today, or excited to talk about the novel that's just come out.
That novel, Most Grievous Fault, could you tell me maybe where did it come from?
Yeah, I can try. I am a radio listener. I like to have the radio on a low volume all the time. And I don't catch the whole story, but I get little snippets of things that run and play in my mind. And of course, on a news clip or on a story, you're getting only part, especially in news, you're getting one angle of a story. And I always find myself thinking, how did they get there? What happened before that? How did they get there? And always thinking also, how will they move forward? And a particular news story a long time ago now, 15 years maybe, caught my interest that way, a hard story to listen to. And I just found myself thinking about the person whose tragedy it was, and also the family, and thinking then also about things that were around me in my own life. And eventually what came out was I wrote, and I was in the MFA program at UBC at the time, and I wanted to try and write a novel. I had written just short fiction before, and I didn't really know how to approach a novel. So I took this character who was imaginary, of course, and wrote a diary. And I wrote a diary for a year, her diary for a year, but not, I didn't write for a year, but I wrote it as quickly as I could. And when I came out of that, I had a manuscript, but it needed a lot of work, and it didn't have any shape, and it didn't have proper structure. And so together with my advisor, Linda Svensson, we worked through that. But I realized right away with talking to her that the mother of this of Becky, in fact, would be a much better protagonist because she is daughter and mother. And so the story then, I also have a background in, I studied religious studies as my undergraduate degree, and I always have had an interest in religion. So I want to put those two things together, a tragedy for this young person and a religious sort of setting that is foreign to them. And so I rewrote it, and it still didn't work. It was very difficult. And I put it aside and thought, I'm not going back to it. It just didn't work. But I sort of had no choice. A crystal was created, and she was there, and she stayed with me. And I owed it to her. So I had to remove myself from her. So I had written it in the first person. So I was very close, first with Becky, and then very close with Crystal. And then I had to back away from Crystal so that I could make it easier for the reader. She's not an easy character. She's not an easy person to be close to.
So you've got this novel. It's about Crystal, who's in her late 20s. She's the mom of Becky, who's maybe 13, 14. You are writing about some really, really heavy issues, intergenerational trauma, things like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. How do you approach writing about such heavy subject matter?
I think to as much as possible, pull myself in as close as I can. So to try to embody that a little bit, to feel it. And I have known people who have this condition, or, you know, obviously there are a lot of hard stories all around us, all of us. And it's, you don't have to go far to be finding somebody who is struggling. And I find it interesting and important to try to understand what is happening. So a person like Crystal, she doesn't have the tools that the next person might have, because her mother was an alcoholic and also abusive. And she comes into the world already crippled, already having a hard time before she's done anything. So to try and imagine is what I had to do, to be this person, and recognizing that there's a little bit of that in all of us. So finding that in me and then letting that kind of bloom and be a bigger part of me while I'm writing the book, and being Crystal's best friend. I had to be her best friend while I wrote the book.
You suggested that you had written this manuscript. It was from the point of view of the daughter and her diary. And then you kind of had put it down. It was something that needed a lot of work. And then you just felt this character of Crystal, the mom, calling you. What do you feel it was that was calling you and tugging at you and getting you to come back and write this and change the perspective?
I think I hadn't been fair to her. I think I hadn't, I had allowed her kind of angry self, which I think is justifiably angry, and all of her flaws, I think are understandable flaws given her circumstance. I hadn't allowed myself to kind of home in on the pain and to find that she, to really think a lot about her hopes and her dreams and how the things that she is hoping for, the things that she is dreaming about and the things that she wants are the things that we are told every day are the things we ought to hope for and ought to dream about and ought to want, like a car and a two-bedroom apartment, a little bit of space, a little bit of privacy, maybe a little bit of money, and love. You know, she wants all the things that every advert tells us we need, but she doesn't know how to get them. So she is manipulative. She considers herself a victim, and she can't get beyond that. So I had to find a way to empathize. I had to step right into her shoes, and I think I was being judgmental in the previous attempts to write the book. I think I was showing a character who wasn't sympathetic enough to the reader. And she isn't sympathetic, but to write a non-sympathetic protagonist is hard. The reader doesn't want to read that. It's hard for a reader to read about an unlikable person because you don't want to be with them, supporting them. I need the reader to support her. So I needed to do that.
A lot of very difficult and unpleasant things happen in the novel to the characters, and I'm wondering about that from a few different points of view. You were just talking about maybe the reader's perspective there. What was it like for you to be kind of the pen that this universe is being created through, to be writing all of these very unpleasant circumstances?
You know, I would get very hot. I would, my whole head sometimes, and then have to come out of it, because I had to get in. I had to be in there. I suppose it's a bit like acting, you know, that you have to step into the role. So, I am someone who likes to step into someone's shoes. I am someone who I like to understand people's stories. I like to know why they are the way they are. And so how was it? It was, again, I guess it's about finding the little bits in you where you have some resentment, for example, towards something, and then you allow your mind to open up there and see what would happen if you acted out on that resentment. And so take away the controls that I might naturally have and see where my brain will run with that. And then obviously in many places have to pull it back or tweak it and rework it with, you know, other eyes on it, or recognizing when things are working or when they're not working. And I think part of it is to make it a believable thing, not to give too much, because number one, it's too hard for the reader. And number two, the reader is better off if there's a lot of it that they have to pull from their own experience of life. And that comes into it in terms of how the story is a meeting place between the writer and the reader. So I'm putting in so much and asking the reader to add the rest.
There were a number of times where I was reading through the book and I was thinking, oh no, don't do this. It's going to have negative consequences. And I've heard of this idea in writing that once you kind of create these characters, maybe you have like the cue card version of how the story is going to play out. But once you get down to actually writing it, things change. And sometimes it feels like the characters are making their own decisions. Did you feel like when you were writing this, did you feel like you were making the choices? Did you feel like Crystal was making the choices. You feel like some other kind of third force was making some of these choices that I imagine someone reading would be like, no, don't do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of no, don't do this. Crystal is her own person. Crystal is a real person. She is with me. A little less so now because now she's out in the world, but she has been with me for a long time. And in fact, when I turned back to the book after putting it away, it was because I was walking. I was in the forest in the endowment lands at UBC, and it was in my head, and I suddenly realized I was talking to Crystal, and I thought, you know, talking away in my head, and there she was. So she just was there with me, and I guess, you know, your character becomes a force. It's, you know, Jean in the book, Jean is Jean, and I can't move Jean around. Jean is who Jean is. They're all. I mean, it's more real. The book is more real to me than, you know, stories of family members who I don't exactly know. I mean, extended family where I don't know exactly where they're living, or I know where they live, but I don't know what their home is like, and I don't know what their daily life is like. I know Crystal and Becky. I know everything about them.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Meg Todd. The Vancouver Island author is speaking with me about her debut novel, Most Grievous Fault. It tells the story of Crystal, who is trying to navigate life in poverty with her teenage daughter, Becky. Were there any maybe perspectives you were hoping to bring to some of the issues that are covered here, things like intergenerational trauma and family violence?
You know, I didn't set out to write anything anything like this, and it's very typical for me that I will just start and just write and finish it and then have to sort out what it is that I've written. I think that the things that are going on around us in the world, different people are moved by different things. So some people are particularly passionate about political instability, and other people about, you know, perhaps refugee issues or environmental issues. And I guess the thing that resonates with me is personal tragedies, personal hardship, the question of how do we move forward through illness, through just so many things that are out of our control. I remember thinking this when I was very young, thinking about that inherent unfairness of life, that one person is born into a good situation with a lot of support, and the next person is born into not a great situation, and that those are things that you have no control, and that it seems so unfair. And I find it very interesting to think about that and think to put myself into another person's shoes. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is just the thing that trickles through me the most. This is the news story that I, you know, just kind of hurts me. So that's the thing I want to examine, whether it's a physical illness or a mental illness, or victim, being a victim, being, you know, not having control, not having control of your mind, not having control of your body. Those are the things that kind of just ripple around in my head. So they come out somehow in the stories. I don't intend for them to.
What do you think on that front is the way a novel explores some of these issues? You know, you talked about how this is something where you started out and you wrote and it's out there, and then maybe you start to like untangle some of the threads after. I'm wondering if you could tell me about just specifically the format of a novel or of fiction in exploring something like personal tragedy. What do you think the way we should view that is?
I suppose that the advantage of a novel is, and for myself in any case, while I was writing it, everything around me trickled in. You know, every little thing trickles into the novel. There's so much space there. There's so much room to build and to create and to make this, you know, enormous oil painting with all the different layers and layered and layered, and the underpainting is all there. Everything is there. And so you have room to explore in this way the nuances, because you can just tweak things just slightly to kind of catch this one thing and also to catch that one thing. Whereas when you're talking with one person who's dealing with one thing, it's a little more narrow. So in other words, like in a nonfiction or in real life, we don't have room to put quite as much in, and we don't have room to be looking at other perspectives. So to have the full story of a second or third character, when I mean it's there, but in that conversation with one person. So I think you are creating a whole landscape that gives you just so much room to explore multiple themes.
Did you ever, while you were writing this, have the urge to maybe just like make some nice things happen to Crystal and give her some big wins?
I thought she had some big wins. Like, I think when she hears her daughter sing, you know, those moments when she has this incredible tenderness, despite herself, tender feelings towards her daughter. And I think she does have good moments. It's just that they, for us, maybe don't seem like good moments, because it's all relative, right? But her life, I think she maintains hope. And she doesn't fully despair, and that's already a good thing. And she feels good about her work. So when she's at work, she is really happy. And she's doing a job that, you know, we don't think of as a great job, but she's good at it. And if you can be good at something, it doesn't really matter what it is. If you can be good at it, that's a big thing. That's a big thing to help you through your life.
I'm wondering about the setting of the novel. It was sort of, you know, there was no line where the book said, "We are in this town." But there were little markers here and there. You know, at one point they go have a celebratory meal at a White Spot. Can you tell me about the place in this novel?
Well, I did. Yeah, I do have a place in my head, you know, for each of the things, but I didn't really want, I think that the issues in the book, the problems are pretty widespread. And I think there are a lot of crystals in the world. And I think I didn't want to sort of, you know, pin it down in one place. But of course, for me, I had to have some geographical parameters mentally.
What were some of the elements from the novel that were maybe autobiographical in nature? What did you pull directly from your own life and experiences?
I did volunteer in the Downtown East Side, like Jean does. It was in the late 80s. And I think that has really stayed with me. We handled, you know, people's social security checks. I think they probably have a different name now. And helped them to find housing, and helped them and gave them a little bit of money, a little bit at a time, so that the money went to, you know, their meals. So as much control as the people needed, or as much as they needed us to take. I was just volunteering, and I was young, and I just found it was profound. People who were It's not that the people were, they just had, some of them had just chosen not to lead the same life that is the life that we consider to be the normal life. They had chosen to do this. Why had they chosen this? You know, was there something, was there a mental illness, some kind of instability, something? And there were also, you know, people with addictions and people with mental illnesses that were that we knew. But yeah, that certainly was there. And also, I am familiar with a very traditional Catholic school. I went to a Catholic high school, non-traditional, but I am not Catholic, and but I'm familiar with Catholicism, and I think that's about it.
You talked there about the idea of choices, and I'm wondering about that in the context of the novel and some of the things, you know, if people were to view some of these experiences as choices, to what extent did you feel like, say, Crystal was making these choices? To what extent did you feel like circumstances had made some of these choices for Crystal? And just what's your reflection on that whole idea of choice versus social determinants of health?
Yeah, well, I think we are always told, well, there's always a choice. And I think there is always a choice. But for some people, the choice is very narrow. So, and it's exactly as you're saying, that those social determinants. And so for some of these people who I saw and knew that they had support from their family, despite the fact that they were living on the street, and they even maybe had housing, but they chose not to be in the housing. There is a reason for the choice, right? But I didn't know the reason. And so that is really part of something that I want with Crystal, is to try to understand her rather than judge her. That to me is just a fundamentally important thing. If we understand someone, even if we disagree with them, we open the door for communication. Even if we don't agree with their lifestyle, or we don't agree with the whatever it is, political mindset, anything, if we try to understand, we can discuss and we can communicate. I find it, I think that judging is without trying to understand, I think that's very difficult, and something that I don't think is healthy for society. I think we need to understand. It's our duty to try to understand. So that was really important to me in the book, and also I think with working down in the downtown East Side, I wanted to understand their stories. I kept thinking, all of these people, you know, they start as a helpless infant. And how did they get here? This I found very interesting.
I'm wondering about that idea of exploring some of those worlds. Again, in the context of a novel, you know, it's not a memoir or a first-person account, and, you know, nowhere does it claim to be. I guess, what do you feel like you did to embody Crystal and to know how to be Crystal?
Yeah, because it's sort of the question of, but sometimes, you know, we talk about with fiction, that are you the person to write this story, right? Yeah, I understand that question. I think it's very close to us, addiction, all around. You don't have to look far to see it. You don't have to look far to see someone who is troubled. And certainly I have seen a lot. I have a lot of people around me who struggle. And I have seen very sad stories. And I think, you know, we say 6 degrees of separation, but I think with things like mental health and addiction, it's much closer. It's 1 degree. And if you think it's not around you, it's I don't think you're looking closely enough at the people around you. There are many forms of addiction, it's what I've written is fiction, but I'm drawing on the many, many, many stories around us. It's pervasive. I don't think I have to reach far.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Meg Todd. She's the author of Most Grievous Fault, a book which tells the story of a mother trapped in a cycle of intergenerational violence. How have things been for you since you got Crystal's story maybe out of you and onto the page and now out into the world coming soon?
Yeah, that is a really great question. And I was just thinking about it today. I was thinking to myself, it's that I've lost control of her. She's now away from me. She's no longer mine. I can no longer sort of, you know, say, Crystal, come on, pull yourself together. I have lost control of Crystal. So now she's out in the world, and it feels a little frightening, you know?
Frightening in what way?
I think she's vulnerable, and I'm kind of scared for her. And I guess I felt like I was protecting her. It sounds very strange, but, you know, that's how I feel. She's on her own now.
So you've let go, you've suggested, you know, you don't have control over Crystal's story anymore. But what would you hope that people who read that story take away from it? What do you hope they do with it?
I hope it, that's a, I mean, I don't know. And I don't really have any hope, but I feel like if we can see a little bit of ourselves in a person like Crystal, and I think if we can have hope, even if it's such a hard story, I think at the same time, for me anyways, I have hopes for Crystal.
Did you feel like with the heaviness of some of the moments in this novel, were there things you maybe did to take care of yourself, or are there things you think a reader might want to do to take care of themselves as they read this?
I think I would have a much harder, I'm not really sure. I mean, sometimes I had to take some space, just time. And but then it also comes down to the very fine sentence by sentence work, where I'm not so much looking at the bigger picture. I'm looking at, you know, is this paragraph working together with the next paragraph? So on the writing level, it's a very pleasant task that I quite enjoy. So once that big picture was done, which was quite a long time ago, I'm more focused on moving the parts around a little bit. So that is the more kind of recent memory that I have of it. And as far as a reader goes, I think, you know, I am a reader who likes to read a hard story. I like a story that is really churns something up for me. But I know some readers don't. They like to have a very, you know, light story.
I'm thinking, for example, if Crystal's story as laid out in the book was something that was a real story and a news organization was somehow going to tell this in the form of a long form article, I'm just imagining that there would be, you know, a number of content warnings ahead, and at the bottom of the page there might be a list of various resources that someone could contact for help. And I'm wondering if that is what you make of that idea or that suggestion.
It did come up. It did come up. I haven't seen the book yet, so I don't actually know if there's a content warning. I was away when during the last bit of the editing, so I'm not actually sure how that was settled. So I'm curious to find out. So, yeah, it of course, some people are very much in favor of content warning, and other people are not. So I think I myself think that we ought to be challenged, and but it's our responsibility to know when we have to be careful. But I suppose with the book, it does in the back though. I think that the book jacket, like the cover copy there on the back, I think is pretty clear that the themes are heavy. So I think that that's there for a reader. And I think that when we try to shelter ourselves too much, this doesn't hold true for everyone, of course, because it really depends on your own background, your own whatever you're dealing with. And it, but I do believe it's all part of communication. It's all part of making ourselves understood to each other. And again, I just go back to that's why I feel like trying to understand people is what we should really think about. I rather than judging, rather than closing the door, I want to open the door. I want to open the door.
Meg Todd is author of the forthcoming novel, Most Grievous Fault. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.